The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and also streaming TV and so much more. And we have a typically fascinating show for you this week. Stephen Garrett will be along to offer up some predictions for this year's Oscars, which are this Sunday, March 2nd. But we're also going to talk about two very excellent HBO-branded shows on Max right now. Paula Schaefer is here to talk about The Pitt, the new show from the makers of ER, which is just really one of the finest medical shows ever put on TV, if not the best ever. But first, I have Matthew Ehrlich on the line, and we're going to gossip about the new season of The White Lotus. The White Lotus season 3 is here. This season is phenomenal and lots of fun, and I hope you all get a chance to watch and enjoy it. Matthew will be along right after this interlude.
สวัสดีค่ะ. Welcome to The White Lotus in Thailand, ค่ะ.
Everyone runs from pain towards pleasure. But they get there only to find more pain.
I put up a piece on Book and Film Globe called Let's Gossip About The White Lotus Season 3, because there's no show on TV I feel like that is more gossip-worthy than The White Lotus. It is back for Season 3, and once again, there are rich people doing outrageous things in an extremely exotic location. And who better to gossip about The White Lotus with than Matthew Ehrlich, one of our chief TV writers? I knew that he had been watching the show and was going to be watching it. So hello, Matthew.
Hey, Neil. Glad to be here.
A lot of dish on the, with this season. So what has grabbed you so far?
You know, I think mainly it's interesting because the first episode left me a little bit like, okay, it's another season of this. I always enjoy this. I'll watch again. And then there's a lot of product placement. Like there's a, I mean, not product placement, but there are a lot of promotional tie-ins. Like, you know that Coffee Mate has a special flavor devoted to White Lotus? There's like Thai iced tea and pina colada flavored Coffee Mate now in honor of the season.
I disapprove. But at least they're not including Coffee Mate in the show, so I guess it's okay.
Yeah, they're not doing that. But so part of me was like, okay, and then you mentioned in your review the Love Boat and Fantasy Island, and I'm like, is that what's happening? The series is running out of steam. Because the way that everyone kind of like introduces themselves when they get off the boat has a very like Love Boat Fantasy Island feel to it. And I just thought, is Mike White phoning this in? But then I have to say the second season grabbed me.
The second episode, you mean?
Second episode, sorry. Yeah, grabbed me. And now I'm like quite fascinated. And I think that a lot more is going on than I ever anticipated. And I'm very excited about the season.
Yeah, I don't think he's phoning it in. I think he is making a commentary on these shows of our youth. That he's sort of ironically deconstructing the myths of those shows, because you know there's a Love Boat quality to the guest stars this year. I mean, it's like Michelle Monaghan, Walton Goggins, Parker Posey, Jason Isaacs, Leslie Bibb, Carrie Coon. You know, it's like it's just this. It's a great cast. There's a great cast, and then you know, and then there are people who may not be familiar to those who don't live in TV land.
Lisa from Blackpink.
Well, Lisa from Blackpink. That's a you know she who I didn't even recognize, but that's a huge star, global.
That's a huge get. Not that I knew this before I did some research on the show itself, but she's huge. She's like the Justin Timberlake of Blackpink.
Basically. Yeah, she's probably the biggest star globally. Certainly bigger than you know. Right. I won't. We love Parker Posey, but you know she is an indie rock movie queen for Gen X.
Right. And, you know, she's playing The Help, so it's very easy to miss her, basically.
She's playing The Help, although that's one of the things that Mike White does so well is that he you know, he takes these guest stars, these rich Americans coming to visit these exotic locales, but he also weaves in the stories of people who work at the resort.
Right.
And, it's such a clever take on the upstairs, downstairs, Downton Abbey formula.
Exactly, yes.
So a lot of juicy stuff going on. Like there's the storyline of the three rich college friends played by
the Cougars.
Cougars played by Leslie Bibb, Michelle Monaghan, and Carrie Coon. And they're obviously going to end up scratching one another's eyes out by the end of the season. We're just trying to figure out how.
Yeah, and it's very interesting to watch Carrie Coon be beta. Usually she's on top if she's playing a character. I'm so used to seeing her as, you know, the one in charge.
Like in The Leftovers and the Gilded Age.
Exactly. So
yeah.
In a way, I wonder if that she's the poor friend who's also along that everyone's kind of talking about behind her back, if that's going to flip. We already got a bit of a hint to that when she was trash talking Jacqueline with Kate.
Well, I've seen rumors and heard rumors that this is based on a relationship that Gwyneth Paltrow had with one of her high school friends. Okay. So it makes some sense. But I mean, but it could apply to sort of any Hollywood star of that era. But that's super juicy. And the idea that Carrie Coon is like the least hot one
of
the group.
Yeah.
So absurd.
Right.
Because she's just so, so gorgeous. And then there's the I don't know. I can't even decide which one's the juiciest. The sort of the Jason Isaacs, Parker Posey family plot line. There's some weird stuff going on with those kids.
Yeah, and yet I don't, like, I have to say this at the risk of maybe, you know, I don't know what, but like I almost feel as though that kind of Southern family is a lot more common than one would think.
Yes.
The fact that there's something incestuous going on among the three of them. And then the idea that, you know, everyone's talking about what a freak Patrick Schwarzenegger is, Saxon is. And I'm like, well, he's a guy in his 20s who's really hot. Of course, he's going to have that really, you know, alpha energy that's going to kind of alienate everyone. But you can also see how he's kind of turning off all the women around him. Like, as a gay man, I'm looking at him and I'm going, yeah. But then if you're a woman, you're kind of like, ew, you know.
Well, how does he relate? How does he stack up against the himbos of previous seasons, right? You had Jake Lacy in season one. And then in season two, it was Theo James who kind of filled that.
I liked Jake Lacy, but I don't think Jake Lacy was supposed to be that hot. He was just supposed to be very privileged.
Yeah.
I mean, even though if you met Jake Lacy in real life, he'd be quite attractive. Whereas like, yeah, Theo James, definitely part of that. But Theo James actually didn't come from money, I believe. He just sort of made it on his own. So there's a different.
Yeah, he was like a nouveau riche. Whereas, right. Look, this family, like the Jason Isaacs character, who is in deep shit. deep business waters. You get the sense that he's, you know, a sleazy finance guy. You don't necessarily get the sense that like this is old money.
Right. But there's money in the family, even if it's new money. And that's basically making Patrick Schwarzenegger a bit of an entitled brat.
And then the third major guest plot line involves Walton Goggins, who is, I think, just absolutely fantastic in this.
Always a pleasure to see him, yeah.
Always a pleasure, sure, but he's really good in this. And he is a man, middle-aged American guy who's with a troubled background, who is involved in, as he says, this and that.
Yes.
So we don't, he's amorphously in the entertainment business. And he's traveling with a suspiciously young, not an underage companion, but a young companion played by Amy Lou Wood, who is a standout supporting character on Netflix's Sex Education. And she is, you know.
Are those teeth a prosthetic or is that her?
No.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. I mean, if they are, then she had them in Sex Education too. Those are her teeth.
Right. Okay. Because I think that's a great look in a sense that you like everything looks amazing about her. And then the teeth make you go, ooh, what's going on there?
And she's British, as they say.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's some of the weirdest teeth of a professional actor I've ever seen. But that aside, like she's extremely funny.
Yeah. And I think that there's something very interesting about their relationship in that you have them pegged immediately as maybe that she's a kept woman or she's sort of the, you know, the babe on the side. But I mean, it's a very screwy situation, but yet the fact that if she were really a kept woman, she wouldn't be making fun of him for being so old. Like there are some things that she's doing that are strategically stupid for a kept woman to be doing. And yet she manages to still be with him. And there are some moments of tenderness between them after she's in the robbery.
They actually have the nicest relationship of, in some ways.
In some ways, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Whereas Chloe and Greg, you know, are that's like, we met in a matchmaking service in Dubai. Oh my God.
Yeah. Well, right. Well, okay. So Greg, you mentioned Greg. Now, Greg is the... There is a returning character in Natasha, who is the sort of the massage therapist from the Hawaii season.
Also, Greg, if you're going to kill someone in season two at a White Lotus, why are you going to another White Lotus to hang out? Is there a reason behind that? Or is that just like, for the sake of storytelling, we got to bring him back?
Well, if you recall, Greg didn't actually kill Tanya in season two. He just
It was the gays.
And Greg was gone.
Yeah.
And he clearly inherited Tanya's money, or else he wouldn't be living in Thailand and like dining at the White Lotus, where I can only imagine how expensive. You know, but the fact that Natasha shows up means that perhaps Greg might still get caught or get implicated somehow. And it also, you know, leaves a lot of obviously the biggest thing to gossip about with any season of the White Lotus is, who's going to die?
Who's going to die? And you know, maybe it's Natasha. Yeah. Because we get that hint at the beginning when the son is saying, you know, about my mother. But I have a feeling that Natasha's not going to die because they are leading us so deeply in that direction.
Yeah, it feels a little obvious. I mean, the first season was, the deaths have been tragic for sure. But I don't feel like, I feel like it would be just too obvious to kill her, and really like tragic in a way that is not fair to the character.
Right. It's too early to detect a pattern, but on Reddit, everyone seems to think that it's always the hot mess who gets it.
Mm.
And, you know, Armand became a bit of a hot mess at the end of season one. So Jennifer Coolidge is a hot mess. Therefore, my money's on Vicky Parker Posey.
No, that seems too obvious to me. Not too obvious. Just, she's too much of a she's too much of a side character. Like, why? What's the point of killing that character?
I don't know. I think there's something more to her that weekend in Houston.
Yeah, I think it was in Houston. I don't know. It's hard to say. I can't imagine. Parker Posey's character to me, it just feels like you have this show with a lot of sort of a dramatic intersecting plot lines, and then there's this little extra bonus of you know, oh look, it's also Parker Posey.
Right. It could be anyone really, but yeah.
It could be anyone. That's the thing. That's the point.
Several times during the episode, Parker Posey has said, you know, she goes, I slept like a corpse, I almost died, blah, blah, blah. There's a lot, like actually every character gets to say that at some point, but they're definitely.
Yeah, well, and that's part of the waking fun of the show, right? And, you know, and I remember the first season of The White Lotus, I didn't watch The White Lotus when it came out initially, so I watched that whole, we binged that whole first season in a week. The second season, we had to sort of watch it serially. But it's, you know, it's hard to watch a show that is this grippingly soapy week to week, but it's the perfect show to watch that way, because you just get to spend all week like going down rabbit holes and like having outrageous discussions with other fans about it. And my own personal life is so boring by comparison, thank God, but but I'm just saying, like, this is the best gossip I've got going on right now. All right, well, Matthew Ehrlich, thanks for bringing the hot goss on The White Lotus Season 3, and I'll talk to you soon.
All right, great. Thanks for having me on. That's great.
The Academy Awards are this Sunday, March 2nd, and I'm going to be celebrating them like I always do. I'm going to put on my nice bathrobe and pour myself a glass of red wine and make bitchy comments at the TV. Like I do every year. I'm like the, I turn into the critic from All About Eve
on Oscar night. Addison DeWitt. You're Addison DeWitt.
I'm Addison DeWitt. And, I know, and my wife sometimes will watch them with me, but no, pretty much like I've been uninvited from any Oscar party I've ever been invited to, because I spent all the whole time going, oh my God. Oh, that's so horrible.
Do you fill out a lonely ballot? It's just you, and then you win every year because you're the only one.
I think maybe it's residual from the 1990s when, let's face it, like a lot. I'll never get over Forrest Gump beating Pulp Fiction, you know, and The Shawshank Redemption. I hold that with as much bitterness in my heart as I do Bush v. Gore. Anyway, the Oscars are this year, and I don't think we're going to be facing something quite so dire. Stephen Garrett, who is obviously here chatting with me.
Hello.
Hello is our chief film critic for Book and Film Globe. Let's start with, I'm going to start with best actress, actually, because that's one of the most contentious categories. It's contentious in the fact that Carla Sofia Gascon is the most canceled Oscar nominee in history.
Wow. And that is fast and hard. Wow.
Yeah. Not going to win. Not going to win. You're basically looking, and I don't think Cynthia Erivo is going to win for Wicked. As much as she would, as she wants to.
As much as she wants to. I think she was better than Ariana Grande, if I could just throw that out. But yes, she's got no chance.
Wow, she outacted Ariana Grande.
I'm telling you.
Amazing accomplishment. Anyway, our three, I'm not going to call it a horse race because I refuse to refer to women as horses, but our three actress race is between Fernanda Torres and I'm Still Here, Demi Moore from The Substance, and Mikey Madison from Anora. And I kind of feel like it's between Demi Moore and Mikey Madison. If you're going to be honest, as much as people love Fernanda Torres and her performance, I think if you're looking at the other awards ceremonies, you've got to make it between those two.
So that's interesting, though, because they could split the vote and then Fernanda Torres could win.
Also possible. I did not see The Substance because, as listeners of this show know, I do not like movies where things come out of other things. I kind of feel like Demi Moore is going to win.
I agree.
I don't think she's going to have a lot of other shots at the Oscar. Maybe I'm wrong, but, you know, Mikey Madison is a much younger actress with a lot of career in front of her. And Fernanda Torres is an amazing performance, and I'm Still Here. But it is a movie in Portuguese.
That is true.
You know, I think I'm Still Here is going to win Best International Picture, almost for sure.
You think that's based on Emilia Perez just completely self-immolating because of Carla Sofia Gascon? She's bringing everything. Yeah. She's bringing the whole chip down.
Yeah, and also I'm Still Here is just, I know you liked Emilia Perez, but I think I'm Still Here is by miles a better film. Regardless, I think I have a vision of Demi Moore holding the statuette. It's going to be one of those moments where, like, oh, you know, because there it happens every year. It's like, oh, Jared Leto is an Oscar winner. Matthew McConaughey is an Oscar winner. Cher is an Oscar winner. And now we're going to be like, okay, Demi Moore.
It's one of the few people that people are like, average people will say, oh, I recognize her and she now has an Oscar. Like, I think they need that to be mainstream.
Yeah, agreed. Foregone conclusion that Timothy Chalamet is going to win Best Actor.
Oh, interesting.
Absolutely. Okay. He's up against some very very strong performance. I personally
really pretty good. Yeah, good
group. I personally love Sebastian Stan in The Apprentice. You know, Ralph Fiennes in Conclave. I suppose I could win. Colman Domingo in Sin Sing. That is a very very indie movie that not a lot of people have seen. Adrian Brody from The Brutalist, maybe, but he's already won an Oscar for what was it that Mickey Glazer called him in one of the Golden Globe Awards?
Two-time Holocaust survivor.
Yeah.
Adrian Brody.
I think Timothy Chalamet is going to win, and he was extraordinary as Bob Dylan.
He was quite good, and they do like to reward people who play real people with Oscars. You did a good job playing a real person.
And playing the guitar, for that matter.
And playing the guitar and singing his own songs and everything. I mean, Ralph Fiennes is great. He hasn't been appreciated in a while, so that'd be nice.
Yeah, but I think it's going to be Chalamet. For Best Supporting Actress, I feel like you're also kind of looking at a competition between A Complete Unknown and Conclave. Monica Barbaro played Joan Baez, and Isabella Rossellini had her sort of her cameo almost as a rogue nun in Conclave. You know, personally, like, I don't know. Monica Barbaro is so amazing to look at. I can't even, you know, I'll admit it. I'm a man. But Isabella Rossellini's acting was better.
It was. You know, it's interesting. You point to something that people are kind of mumbling about, which is like A Complete Unknown, totally dominating and winning major categories for its nominees, which I think would be very interesting because it's a mainstream hit that people aren't really talking about as being zeitgeisty, but I think enough people really love and admire.
You think including Best Picture?
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, I guess it'll be Anora because all the PGA and the DGA and blah, 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 blah. Everybody's been voting for it. But.
Right. And so along those lines, I think that Sean Baker is going to win Best Director for Anora. Right. You know, James Mangold, you know, directed A Complete Unknown. I mean, there are some, you know, it's Brady Courbet for The Brutalist also has been getting a lot of accolades.
You know, wait, can we rewind very quickly with actress and supporting role? I would say Zoe Saldana, I think, of the Emilia Perez nominees. She is the one most likely to win, I think. Don't you?
Emilia Perez is not winning anything. It is not winning anything, and it will be relegated to the dustbin.
Damn.
I truly believe that. Mine is not a minority opinion on Emilia Perez. It's widely despised by the right and the left, by Americans and Mexicans, and not by you. You gave it 5 stars, which
I love it.
I know. It's, to me, it's like your most baffling review ever, but you know.
I love big swings.
Yes. Well,
hey. But I would say, I think people want to see Isabella hold that statue more than Monica.
Yeah.
I think that she's got the edge.
I want to see her thank her mother, Ingrid Bergman. I mean,
right?
Isabella Rossellini thanked her mother, Ingrid Bergman, when she was a judge on Chopped. So she's definitely going to do it when she wins the Oscar. And I love that your main contenders for Best Director are Sean Baker, Brittany Corbet, and Coralie Fargeot. What an interesting mix. And, you know, James Mangold also.
That I don't understand. I think James Mangold might come. I see that being the complete unknown stealth win. But Coralie Fargeot, I don't know.
No, she's not going to win.
Really?
She's not going to win.
I don't think she's going to win.
I think Sean Baker's going to win. I feel.
Sean or Brady.
Yeah, and that's, you know, sure. That's like, those are interesting directors. And you know, both of whom have come out during this award season and talked about how little money they make, which I think is really interesting.
Do you know, can I posit something? I think Sean and Brady are both up for directing and for writing. And I could see one of them one and one of them get the other if they share the love a little bit, spread the love around. Because both of them did an amazing job writing and directing very original stories.
Yeah, agreed. All right, so Best Supporting Actor, we're going to real quick. I mean, it's obvious to me. I mean, it's, first of all, Kieran Culkin and Jeremy Strong, the stars of Succession, are both nominated
amazing.
And both deserving.
Amazing.
And both deservedly. So, I mean, I think that that's a really strong group with Guy Pearce and the Russian guy from Anora and Edward Norton from A Complete Unknown. But I think Kieran Culkin's going to win. I mean, he won the SAG award last night. And I think, you know, it's going to be another one of those like, oh, Kieran Culkin, Oscar winner. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I would say, yeah, exactly. I think that was a tricky role for any other actor to pull off in a really, really deceptively nuanced, strong story and script. But that said, my favorite Strong is Jeremy Strong, who is amazing. I mean, just knows how to dial it just too much,
so good.
You know, so that it's slightly overacting in the best way. And is just amazing as Roy Cohn and transformed, you know.
Yeah, and both he and Sebastian Stan are great. And then I think
but Strong is so much better than Stan. They're both good, but Strong is amazing. Maybe it's just a showier role. It's showier.
It's a more interesting part. But I mean, for Sebastian Stan to make Donald Trump even marginally sympathetic as a movie character is to me a good feat.
Yeah.
And an excellent performance. I love that movie. I know that the director is facing some accusations of bad behavior on Twitter because it's Twitter and perhaps he behaved badly, but also but I wish that had been in the top 10, but I understand why it's not. All right. Best picture. You know, there's 10 nominees. I still think we should go back to the day of 5 nominees because there's probably 7 here that can't possibly win and aren't even being discussed. So it's really at this point, I think, between Anora, Conclave and A Complete Unknown.
Really? Conclave? Man, I thought that was such a mediocre movie. I don't understand why everybody loves it.
I'm trying to think of like what's going to win.
Right, right.
We have a dying Pope. Perhaps that's like a very extremely advanced form of Oscar marketing. I don't know.
I think he started dying after the voting closed, though. Let's face it.
Oh, right. After the conclave. the Oscar. Yeah. I mean, look, I love A Complete Unknown. I would be thrilled if A Complete Unknown won. I wouldn't kick the brutalist out of bed as an Oscar winner.
It could be the consensus choice, Complete Unknown.
It could be. I mean, I mean, I love that movie. I saw it twice. I just was completely bought everything that it was doing. But I also, you know, I saw Anora. I saw a while ago now. And I, you know, I bought into that as well. Like it's, you know, it's a quality picture, and it has at least somewhat of a popular touch, given that it's a movie about a Russian prostitute in Brighton Beach, you know.
Hooker with the heart of gold. Who would have thunk? I've never seen that story before.
Yeah, I know.
No, it was done very well, and there's some great stuff in it for sure. Just feels small. To your point, it just feels a little small. I think Complete Unknown feels like a big, splashy Hollywood movie. I love Dune Part 2. I wish that would get it.
Dune Part 2 is not going to win.
But Best it's been out Dune. Of the conversation. So
I mean, you can love Dune Part 2 like everyone else. I mean, no one, not that many people dislike Dune Part 2, but you know, it's like it's not going to win. And then there are a bunch of other movies that I'm not even going to mention here because they're just simply not going to win, which doesn't mean they're bad. I mean, they were still nominated for Best Picture, but you know, I don't know. I don't know where to go on this. Like, I feel like Anora is gonna take it, but I would be. It's not as strong. To me, like the strongest year in recent memory was 2019 when Parasite beat Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. This is not that group, but it's still like I would say, you know, for people who like movies, who love movies, I say it's still a pretty interesting field.
Very interesting, yeah, for sure. I mean, my heart is with The Brutalist. I love that movie. Anora, I think, is great. I wouldn't be sad if any of these. I think you're right. I mean, Anora, Brutalist, Complete Unknown, Dune Part 2.
Dune Part
2. No, I mean, I would be only upset if Conclave won, because come on, Conclave. We're all better than Conclave.
That's what you think. But if Dune Part 2 wins, I will spill wine all over my bathroom.
Oh, I don't want that to happen.
No, the cleaning fees are extraordinary.
Could be Emilia Perez. Could be Emilia. Maybe that's
if Emilia Perez wins, I will spill wine all over your bathroom. I will come to New York and dump a bottle of wine over your head. And it'll all be your fault. All right, Stephen Garrett, thank you so much. This has been the 2025 Book and Film Globe Oscar Preview, your essential one-stop shop for all things Oscar and preview.
Conan O'Brien will be hosting, folks. Tune in.
There's that, too. That deserves an Oscar in and of itself. All right, Stephen, I'll talk to you later.
Yep. Morning, Jack.
You got the med students and new interns starting today.
Lucky, lucky me.
This is the job that keeps on giving.
Ulcers.
The attorney here now!
Suicidal tendencies. And nightmares.
Take the fucking nail out of my heart!
Welcome to the pit. Let's go save some lives.
Like a lot of TV viewers, I have fallen into the pit this year. I'm talking about the HBO medical drama The Pit, which is airing every week, stars Noah Wiley from ER, and the executive producer is John Wells, who is one of the lights behind ER as well. So this has a very ER-like feel to it, but it's updated and it's faster and I think even better than ER was. And Paula Schaefer is our resident pit head, and she is here with her new improved recording sound system to talk to me about it. Hello, Paula.
Hey, yeah, I'm a pithead in so many ways because I'm from outside of Pittsburgh also.
So you could have, if you'd accidentally like screwed something into your hand or had a cyst, you know, that erupted or something, you could have gone to this hospital. This imaginary hospital.
Yes, in an imaginary world where I imaginarily live there, I could go to this imaginary hospital.
Yeah. That's the thing is like the pit makes it almost, you almost want to go to the emergency room because the doctors are all so caring. And competent, and the technology is so good. And this show is a real knockout. I was skeptical. Like I haven't watched a medical show. You know, you're probably not quite old enough to remember Saying Elsewhere when it was on. Maybe you are. I don't know exactly. But that's one of my favorite TV shows of all time. And I loved ER the first couple of seasons, but it was the 90s, and I had other things to do. But now I don't have other things to do. So I'm like all in on this, on The Pit. I think it's just an incredible show.
Yeah, I didn't watch ER either. I was too young and then I was, you know, too pretentious for television. And now television's all I want. So
yeah,
right there with you.
I'm definitely not too pretentious for television anymore. But, you know, here there's a few things about The Pit that really, really grabbed me. One is just the verisimilitude is the word I'm looking for, of the medical procedures. I watched some of the special extras on the app, and obviously, like the actors who are playing the ER doctors didn't go to medical school, but they went to medical mime school, basically, where they spent weeks learning how to physically do these really complicated procedures.
Yeah, I read that they actually try to, because they have several ER doctors on the set with the actors, and they try to run through the procedures with the actors like before they do it, like the day before, so that the next day they'll have some muscle memory because they want them to look like they're doing it. And then the ER nurses, like who are just the extras, are actual ER nurses. So when they're setting it up, they're really setting it up.
It looks real. I mean, it looks and feels real the way they talk. You know, there are quips here and there. And there are, it's not just all a show about medical procedures. I mean, there are characters, there is drama, but the medicine just feels, especially the emergency medicine parts, feels crisp. You know, some of the sort of side plots where people are check in for a couple, two or three episodes, some of that feels kind of like House MD on steroids.
Yep.
You know, I said to my wife, I was like, okay, maybe in the course of a year or two, all of these things would happen in one ER, but you know, everything's happening. The gimmick of the pit is it's all happening in one day.
Yes.
Right. You have every episode is quote unquote an hour on the shift of this senior doctor. Now, if you want to feel old, played by Noah Wiley.
Yeah. And I mean, that's how we know it's not realistic, because they'll be like, your results will be back in an hour. And the results are back the next episode. Whereas, you know, in real life, they'd be like, your results will be back in an hour. And six episodes later, we'd see that person.
There have been some moments where I said to my wife, I'm like, are they still in the hospital? Is this guy still there? And there are some, like there's that guy who's just been sitting in the waiting room since episode one, and they keep cutting back to him getting more and more frustrated because he's still sitting in the waiting room. So there's that. And there's also like, there's this deeply emotional core to the show. I mean, it's very intense. The emotions are extremely intense, especially when it comes to dealing with death.
Yeah, I was really surprised by that. I you know, turned it on thinking, this might be garbage. And then I watched the first four episodes, like, in one sitting. And I was like, okay, I'm hooked on this. And it's because there's so much feeling. Like, it's not afraid to lean into the feeling and not in a, like, schmaltzy, like, you know, they don't use a score to make the music make you feel things. They let the actors do it.
Yeah, the actors are great. And, you know, as someone who's dealt with, you know, a lot of grief in the last decade. I lost both my parents. I had to put a beloved dog to sleep. You know, the way they deal with death in that setting feels very real to me and very earned. And the performances are excellent without being over the top melodramatic.
Yeah, there's like a dignity to the whole thing that I didn't expect.
Yeah, it's really excellent. And the ensemble is terrific. I mean, Noah Wiley is really, really brings out all the stops playing Dr. Rabinovich. I don't know if Noah Wiley is actually Jewish in real life, but it's one of the most realistic Jews I've ever seen on screen. You know, it's a teaching hospital, and he's the senior doctor running the ER. And he's also traumatized because his mentor died during COVID. So you have these occasional flashbacks to the hospital very brief flashbacks to the hospital. I don't know if I could watch a whole show about a hospital during COVID.
No, nobody wants that.
Nobody wants that. But the flashbacks provide some context, you know?
Yeah, and the timing of the show is good because it is a post-COVID world, so that gives us something fresh. Like,
yes.
These doctors are tired, but yet look how compassionate they still are.
Well, they're not all tired. They're not all tired, though, which is one of the things I like about it. There's a young cast of gee whiz eager interns, and they are extremely appealing. The young woman, Dr. Mel, played by Bryan Cranston's daughter, she's sort of a vaguely on the spectrum doctor with glasses, very kind of nerdy. I loved how she, when she had a stressful moment, she stepped outside and like was reciting the lyrics of a Megan Thee Stallion song.
Yeah.
Or when she sits in the stairwell watching a lava lamp app on her phone.
Yeah.
And those are the kinds of details that separate this from, you know, Chicago Med, for instance. You know, so there's like it's just like a young, attractive cast, high emotional content, and like really realistic medical stuff. I did want to talk about the politics of the show with you a little bit.
They do dabble into it, but not in a way that seems intolerable so far.
Yeah, it's like this is the way to do Blue State, right? There is one brief trans patient who is misgendered on their chart, but that they discarded that pretty quickly. The show is clearly pro-multiculturalism, pro-choice. It's Blue State, you know, it's definitely, but I don't think you would have to have a heart of stone to watch this and not be affected by it, because, you know, a lot of this stuff is kind of transcends ideological lines. But there are moments where I'm watching it where I'm like, I wonder, like, what the show would be like if it were taking place at an ER in Birmingham, Alabama.
Right.
Or Dallas, you know what I mean? Like, there would be some different vibes.
Yeah, it definitely does try to, like, it allows itself to have the blue through it. But I think it tries to do it in a way so it's not pushing away the red. You know, it tries to play it kind of purple.
Kind of. Well, it's kind Pittsburgh is, I would say, a blue city, but it definitely, like, borders a lot of sort of purple areas. You know, it's like, it's there's this very, you probably haven't seen this scene yet, but there's a plot line where, you know, they suspect that a father is molesting his tween daughter. And it goes in real hard in the paint again. I mean, it's not like a courageous stance to be against child molestation or sex trafficking, but the show does that, and it does it in a way that I think would appeal to a broad audience. And that's the thing about this show, is I feel like it really has broad appeal.
Yeah, I think that the phrase that I saw that I'm going to steal and use for this, it is competence porn.
Yeah, these they don't make any. I mean, patients die. There are deaths in the show, but it's not because the doctors are making mistakes or are evil.
Yeah, they care. They're competent. They're present. They're there. That's what we want from the medical system. And so it's kind of like a better world, even though all the bad stuff is there.
Because the first line of defense is not breaking down. I don't know if that's actually true or not, but it's true in the case of this show. All right, so before I let you go, who is your favorite doctor on The Pitt?
I mean, Noah Wiley is such a fine, fine performer. I feel like in a more just world, he would be the George Clooney. Like, I have always felt like he deserved all of the accolades that George Clooney scoops up just by existing. So it's hard to go into a show starring Noah Wiley and not feel like, yes, this is who I want to see. However, I do like Trinity, the doctor who's like the newbie, who's really arrogant, and she like keeps giving people nicknames they don't want, and she just doesn't have any people skills, and like she's suspicious of everything. I'm really interested in that character, and that actress, I think, brings something to that role that is intriguing rather than off-putting.
Yeah, she's excellent, and that is the character who is the sort of the most morally suspect. I agree with you about Noah Wiley. I also really like Trinity, but I love Dr. McKay, played by Fiona Dourif, who is the daughter of Brad Dourif, who did the voice of Chucky in the Child's Play movies. And she's been in some of the Child's Play movies. I just think that character is really great. You know, she's wearing some kind of ankle monitor. She did something. We don't know what it is yet. And also, like, she's a doctor who's an intern, but she's in her 40s. So she's not like a kid. I have a hard time relating to Gen Z doctors, but I can definitely relate to a millennial doctor with addiction issues.
Yeah, yeah, that character definitely, Dr. McKay, you know, like Shrek, Dr. McKay has layers. She's an onion. We don't know. And will we even get to see it? How many seasons will it take?
Well, right. Well, they have renewed it for a second season. But yes. But like you said in your piece, when you're really just dealing with 15 hours in a day, you're not. Dr. Collins isn't going to have her baby, and probably isn't going to lose her baby during the course of the show. We may not even find out who the father is, although we all have our suspicions. So some of the more soap operatic elements of an hourly TV medical drama, they're muted on this show because people can't get married and hook up and break up. And
I mean, they can, but wow, that would be hard to follow.
It's not Grey's Anatomy.
That it is not. That is the number one thing I will say about The Pitt. It is not Grey's Anatomy.
It is the anti-Grey's Anatomy. It is a lot like ER, but, you know, it's also 30 years later. So I just think the quality of the TV making is higher.
Yeah, it's a top shelf show.
The Pitt is a winner. Please, if you find yourself having a medical emergency, get yourself to Pittsburgh. Don't go to your local hospital. You got to go to Pittsburgh because that's where all the good doctors are, apparently.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, Paula Schaefer, thank you so much.
Thanks, Neil.
All right, thank you so much, Paula Schaefer. The Pitt is airing once a week.
on Max. The White Lotus is also airing once a week on Max. I wish they aired every day. I wish I had a fresh episode of both those shows every day. Thanks to Matthew Ehrlich for stopping by to talk about the characters on The White Lotus Season 3 like they are real people. They're real to me. They're my imaginary friends who I gossip about from TV. Also, thanks to Stephen Garrett for helping me preview this week's Oscars. They are Sunday, March 2nd, hosted by Conan O'Brien. I will be watching them in the dark, or at least in a dimly lit room, holding a glass or bottle of wine, wearing one of my three bathrobes. Maybe I'll switch bathrobes up every so often just to kind of give the evening some variety. And my wife will be wandering in and out of the room as I complain about who wins and who doesn't win. In any case, I hope you enjoy the Oscars. I hope you enjoy whatever you're reading and watching. I'm Neil Pollack. Thanks for joining me. I will be back next week.
Original production. The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at the Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's the Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.